Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. First of all, thank you for coming this afternoon. I know there are a lot of things vying for your attention in lovely Las Vegas, and I'm very glad you chose our session. We're going to be talking about the issue of commercial auto predictive modeling. Our original title was The Same and Yet Completely Different, and it was really a reference to this idea that commercial auto predictive modeling takes a lot of cues, a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts from personal auto predictive modeling, and yet there's a whole wide universe of additional things that you can do in commercial auto that really don't have a basis or an application in personal auto. So that's what we're going to talk about. Commercial auto predictive modeling, the same and yet completely different. I'm honored today to have Brett Nunes working with me. It's always a joy and a pleasure to have somebody that you've worked with over the years and has become an incredible consultant in his own right speaking with you. So it's a very proud moment for me and an honor to be speaking with Brett. And without further ado, we're going to get started. I've got handouts back in the back, so if you didn't grab one, feel free to do so. Okay. My part of the session is entitled Rules of the Road, and I'm borrowing a title from a Best Review article that I wrote that came out earlier this week. So if you haven't seen this week's Best Review yet, when you get home, my article's in it. In July, and this to me is really indicative of kind of the state of where we are in commercial auto predictive modeling, there was a really neat National Underwriter article that said even long-haul trucking, a very kind of unique little corner of the commercial auto landscape, is experiencing an environment where the insurers in that space, even some of the large self-insurance and alternative markets programs, are using predictive modeling and targeted pricing as a vehicle to develop a competitive edge as that market's rates continue to soften. And there were some really neat things in the article, and you'll find me kind of flipping back to this periodically through the course of my presentation. Why commercial auto first? Of all the commercial lines, why was the initial transfer from personal lines to commercial auto? First of all, in my humble opinion, no offense, Beth, but it's the weakest of the commercial auto rating plans. When I can go out and find a Peterbilt truck rated as light local service in most of your in-force books of business, there's a problem with the rating plan. The classifications aren't fine enough. They're not verifiable enough. They're easily abused. When the market's hard, it's rated commercial. When the market's soft, it's rated service. It's got some inherent flaws to it. The exposure data is as good as you're going to find in any of the commercial lines, and so that helps with the predictive modeling process. There's an incredible amount of external data available with some really significant leveraging opportunities, whether it's SIC codes or decoding commercial auto VINs or MVR scoring on the fleet of drivers or credit scoring or census data or economic data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. There's all sorts of neat things that you can bring to bear on a commercial auto predictive modeling process. And as I said, there are lots of neat parallels and lessons that were learned in personal auto that you don't have to learn a second time. So it's the biggest opportunity for the biggest improvement. That's why the initial flight to commercial auto several years ago. Let me give you a little background for those of you that don't operate in this space. For those of you that do, this is kind of remedial. Trucks, tractors, and trailers are kind of the primary segment of commercial auto. And the primary rating for TTTs is on what's called a primary class factor, a primary rating factor that combines the size of the vehicle, so gross vehicle weight when you're dealing with trucks, or gross cargo weight when you're dealing with semi-tractors. Use is broadly categorized as service, which means you drive to a job site, you park the truck, you leave it there, you drive it back to the yard at the end of the day, in theory, hint, hint, wink, wink. Retail, which means you're driving to people's homes all day, so like a florist shop, a dry cleaner, something like that. And everything else goes into commercial. So if you're delivering to businesses, you're commercial. Commercial is this kind of big nebulous blob of stuff that doesn't fit the other two categories. Radius of operations is defined as less than 50 miles, 50 to 200, and greater than 200. Fleet versus non-fleet has been arbitrarily assigned at 5 vehicles. And secondary class tries to pick up at least a rudimentary reflection of industry group. Physical damage for trucks is only by the original cost, new, and the age of the vehicle. So if we were to go look at our favorite rating bureau or independent primary class factors, they might look something like this, where there's a three-way interaction between the weight of the vehicle, the radius of the vehicle, and the use of the vehicle. Secondary class factors, pretty straightforward. You break them down into industry segments, and then you have an additive factor that impacts the primary class factors. As should be a surprise to no one, the all other contractors group and the not otherwise classified are the two most frequently used, especially secondary class 99, because there's no impact on rates. And so it's not uncommon to find a whole bunch of light local service, not otherwise classified vehicles, because it's the lowest rate in the truck, tractor, trailer class plan. Private passengers are something that present their own challenges. Liability is rated on territory and limit only, physical damage on age and cost new, not symbol, and there's very, very limited driver rating. So it's a very simplified process for those of you that are used to personal auto rating. All the things that are done really well in personal auto, they're not done very well here. Here's what the operator experience factors look like, typically. Here's the problems that this creates. Primary class factors are often hard to verify. If you're not VIN-decoding, you can't verify weight. Most of you, even if you're doing that, may miss that pickup trucks with dual rear wheels are actually medium trucks, even though you would think, gee, it's a pickup, it must be light. There are better groupings of industry available than secondary class and weight class. ICC weight classes, I mentioned the typical weight classes are light, medium, heavy, and extra heavy. ICC has 8 weight classes, and I'll show you some of that in a second. There's better breaks of industry than secondary class. For example, you could use the first 2 or first 3 positions of SIC code to get better refinement, and actually something that's verifiable instead of use and secondary, which aren't verifiable characteristics. And I'm always a big fan of something I can verify all the time on every risk. You get a tainted industry set of relativities, because to the extent that your competitors, even though you are virtuous and pure and you're reporting commercial when it's commercial every time, your competitors, they know who they are misrating stuff as service instead of commercial, and they're screwing up the unit stat data and screwing up the relativities. Because I know it's none of you guys, but all those folks that didn't come to the seminar, they're doing it wrong. Physical damage is only rated on age and cost new. And again, it's still rarely verified, and there's no symbol rating, which creates a huge problem. Other issues. Trucks versus cars gets kind of nebulous when you deal with hybrid vehicles. Hybrids sometimes get rated as private passenger type, sometimes as trucks, and there's room for ambiguity, I think, is one of the comments I've heard. There's no reflection of personal use, and I'll tell you, there's a difference between a contracting operation where those pickup trucks go to the yard and are parked every night, and another contractor with the same trucks and the same drivers that drives those trucks to the football field or the softball field on Friday night with a cooler full of beer. There's no reflection of that in most commercial auto rating plans, and that's a huge discontinuity. There's no scoring, at least in the rating plan, and there's, you could argue, schedule rating, but there's no tangible reflection of driver characteristics, such as prior accident history, driver age, citations or suspensions or restrictions on their license, all of which are pretty common characteristics in personal auto rating plans. There's no reflection of insured characteristics, like years in business, credit score, on-site ownership versus absentee ownership, drug screening of drivers. And there's also severe adverse selection between personal auto and commercial auto. Let me give you this challenge. Take a portion of your private passenger type vehicles across the hall, you know, down through to the personal auto rating unit, and have them rate up some segment of your private passenger type fleet and see what kind of rate they produce on your drivers and your cars. Because you know what? The 19-year-old son of the business owner who's driving that brand new Corvette while he's away at college, he rates up a little different in the personal lines manual than he does in your commercial lines manual. When we've gone through that exercise with clients, and back when I was a company actuary with my employer, typically it's not unusual to see the commercial private passenger type rates coming out at 25 to 40% on average of what the private passenger rating plan would produce. That's how much of a dislocation you're getting. That's why the owner's son's on the commercial policy. That's why the Corvette or the Mercedes or the Lexus is on the commercial policy. Is the private passenger type rating is so primitive relative to what our friends in the personal auto universe are doing. What are we seeing today in the marketplace? Every once in a while, it's kind of neat. I get a client that says, Rob, go tell me what the top 20 commercial auto writers are actually doing right now. And what we see is a lot of tiered LCMs, you know, that's been around for as long as time, and the variations by vehicle type and maybe by coverage, so you don't put deviations in for UM and you do for BI and PD. And some variations by territory exist. Maybe you like rural and you don't like urban or vice versa, and you vary those by territory. We are seeing some independent primary class and secondary class factors and some really neat stuff with SIC code and package modifications to target specific industries and really accentuate what we're doing in work comp or in package. Interestingly, we're seeing premium discounts. We're seeing a very work comp feeling variation by size of risk cross over into commercial auto. I'm not really a huge fan, but I know what they're trying to do, and it does produce an interesting effect. And we are seeing some interesting simplified experience rating mechanisms. Our friends from National Underwriter pointed out a couple things that I want to kind of draw your attention to, and they mention it for trucking, but I think it's pretty applicable for all of commercial auto. The first is this idea of better safe than sorry, that we're seeing a lot more proactive approach to safety, and I'll show you an example of that in a second. The other thing is this emphasis on predictive modeling and really trying to get to a better price point on a commercial auto risk. Several years ago, we took the data from Texas. Texas is really kind of nice because the data is publicly available and you can kind of do a straightforward predictive model on the industry's unit stat data. And it was three accident years and it had some neat stuff to it. It had territory and coverage, primary and secondary class, and so on. And we went through a predictive modeling exercise. And part of what we found out was that the fleet versus non-fleet relationship between the blue and the green line varies depending on where you are in the class van. There's really not an indication that you ought to have a uniform fleet factor, at least not across the Texas data. The other thing we saw was a real compression, for example, between service, light local service, and light local commercial. What was currently in the Texas class plan was a much steeper relationship than what was indicated in the data. And I would suggest to you that part of the reason you're seeing that compression is that what was really going into service, just look how many exposures are listed in light local service. Look at all these guys. Was really light local service plus a big chunk of light local commercial. The U.S. Census Bureau does a really cool census called the Census of Transportation. And what it does is shows you vehicles by county, by SIC code, by size, by all sorts of things. And if you go to that for the state of Texas and you try and do your own guesstimate of how many of those trucks really ought to be light local service based on the industry they operate in, I guarantee you there aren't that many light local service trucks in the entire state of Texas. They're not there. So part of what we're dealing with is a kind of a garbage in, garbage out system. And so what's happening is these commercial trucks are being rated as service. And so the difference between service and commercial is being diluted. To the extent that the data is not pure, to the extent that the data that's in service isn't just service, but it's also diluted with some commercial stuff that's being misrated, it's going to tend to dampen those relationships and remove some of the predictive difference. We did the same thing for comp and saw some very interesting results, and similarly the same thing for collision. And hopefully what that gives you is some sense of how you might use predictive modeling just to tighten up your primary class factors. In addition, we're seeing a variety of other things and doing a variety of other things that have to do with the rating plan, things like adding ICC weight classes, so you've got 8 weight breaks. Things like SIC codes, varying radius of operations. Progressive really kind of set the stage here by coming up with their own brakes and varying that. And it makes an awful lot of sense. If you look at, I mean, go grab your Rand McNally and just kind of look at that big grid back in the back. And look at some of the cities that are just more than 50 miles away from each other, like Cincinnati to Dayton, or just less than 50 miles from one another. I want to say San Jose and San Francisco are just under, and Dayton to Cincinnati is just over. And is there really any reason, just based on it being a 48-mile radius or a 52-mile radius, to differentiate those two kind of symbiotic cities? So interesting stuff on varying radius of operations. Territory definitions have a great sense of applicability in commercial auto. The ability to really refine territory below city and county. Driver rating is just screaming to be addressed in commercial auto. Both age and violations and restrictions, youthful surcharges, all sorts of neat applications. The number of vehicles or the number of drivers depends on how you can get your data, depends on how you want to model it, but you can choose one or the other of those. And several of these things lend themselves quite nicely to underwriting scorecards. And I'll show you a couple from actual honest-to-goodness in-force filings that I think will pique your interest. Anytime you start pulling filings and putting them on slides, you need a subtle warning. So this is my subtle warning. Just because Hartford filed this, or because auto owners filed this, or because farmers filed this, does not mean this is appropriate for you. So please, take this as informational only. Please don't go home and file it with an explanatory memo that says, Rob Walling said this was perfect for me. Anyway. When we talk about ICC weight classes, RL Polk captures commercial auto VIN data just like they do personal auto VIN data. And the first 11 positions of a Mack truck or a Volvo truck or a Peterbilt truck gives you the same kind of descriptive information that personal auto VINs do. And one of the things that it gives you on a verifiable basis, if you've got a good first 11 of VIN, is the ICC weight class. Not light, medium, heavy, and extra heavy, but eight brakes that are much more detailed, that give you a much more precise understanding of how big this truck is. This is an approach that Progressive's using. A number of other companies are using this kind of verifiable way of identifying a finer brake in commercial auto weight class. And it really does deliver the goods. It's a much more accurate and verifiable way to assign vehicle weight. In terms of SIC codes, I show this slide to you for the pure and simple reason that it demonstrates that you don't always have to keep the data at the same level of granularity all the way through your data set. In some cases, I was able, in this particular modeling assignment, to drill down to the first three positions of SIC code. And I still had credible data that produced a meaningful result. In some other areas, like printing and publishing or industrial machinery, it didn't work as well, and so we consolidated one level further and just went on first two. So we kind of had a hybrid industry class or industry characteristic that in some cases was first three of SIC and in some cases was first two, and it produced a more stable, more predictive result doing this kind of hybrid approach. Here's an actual filing, and I forget whose it is, and I apologize for that. But this is straight out of a filing that we pulled from our favorite insurance department, and I give it to you as an informational item. One of the other interesting things we're seeing is, and I think this is Hartford's Sentinel product, is that they're going to package discounts. And the one thing I'd point out here is it's not just, it's a combination of commercial auto and BOP. But the industry groups are not the original policy types that, you know, kind of come out of the ISO Division 9 manual. They've gone to a finer cut. And so it's just wholesalers that are getting the 15% package discount when you write the BOP and the auto. It's just restaurants. It's just artisan contractors, not all contractors. So it's a really neat approach to recognizing some industry segments that aren't as broad as policy type that do give them some significant lift when they write the BOP and the auto together. In terms of territorial redefinition, commercial auto is a really tremendous place to do that. And one of the really neat things that comes out of it is we're really reinterpreting what similar or near means for clustering. Obviously, two zip codes that have similar peer premiums are similar, but if they've got similar traffic densities, or they've got similar population densities, that can contribute to similarity as well. And so clustering is really, and there's a really cool session going on right now. I'm sorry you're missing it, but there's there's really cool stuff going on right now in terms of really reinventing and moving this idea of what makes two zip codes or two territories similar for clustering possible. So some really neat stuff in terms of enhancing your territories beyond what's there, because some of your commercial auto territories are 30, 40, 50 years old in some states. In terms of driver scoring, you know, it's always funny talking to personal lines actuaries because they like talking about, oh man, we got such a problem. We got, you know, mom and dad and two kids and we've got three vehicles, and how are we going to assign drivers to vehicles? And you know, you're commercial auto people by and large, and you kind of chuckle and say, yeah, I got a medium-sized fleet of 120 drivers to match up with 50 vehicles. You can't do it. And so what we see is an approach that says, look at average MVR score, look at average driver age, look at average youthfuls as a percentage of the total population. Now, I'll tell you, in some cases where you've got dedicated drivers and occasional drivers, you need a weighting approach that says that the dedicated drivers have to contribute to those averages differently than somebody that normally is working in the warehouse, but you know, once in a while I'll get handed the keys and say, we need somebody else to drive a load. So there are some ways to weight that and kind of intentionally bias those averages. But in general, what we found in a lot of our commercial auto studies is that average driver age does materially impact indicated pure premium. So we're starting to understand who we're insuring, not just what we're insuring. And to take that one step further, we've seen a number of situations where even doing average driver age, there is still an additional opportunity, there is still an additional predictive difference, a meaningful difference, if you look at the percentage of the drivers on the risk that are youthfuls, even beyond average driver age. It's a really fascinating result that if it's a small business and all three of the owner's kids are listed on the policy as summer workers that get to drive their Corvettes at college, it does affect the results. So youthfuls and average driver age both have a place here. Number of driver restrictions. We looked at restrictions other than protective lenses, so any other restriction on the driver's license, and again, that comes straight out of the MVR. And again, we saw a fairly meaningful separation if a high percentage of the drivers had some kind of restriction on their license. Number of vehicles is really interesting. You know, I've always kind of wondered why five? You know, why not seven or 3 or 10. You know, in North Carolina, everybody files an exception that says a fleet's 2, right? Anybody know why? Because you can't schedule rate a non-fleet in North Carolina. So everybody files an exception that says it's 2, so I can schedule rate a fleet of 3 vehicles. Okay, so when you start looking at the data in more detail, and we've had a number of opportunities to do that, what we found is 5's different than 10. And 10's different than 15, which is different than 20, which is different than 50 or 100. So what we found out is there are some more meaningful breaks, some really significant separation as the fleet continues to get bigger. It's not just a single inflection point. What we see is actually a more meaningful and more almost continuous. It's not really continuous, but there are more breaks than just at 5 vehicles. And lots of interesting reasons for that. I'll show you an example from Hartford in a minute where they looked at not just number of vehicles, but mix of vehicles. And the result they came to was that not only does the number of vehicles matter, but whether they're all trucks or whether they're half trucks and half private passenger types is incredibly important to understanding what a fleet is and how that impacts expected pure premiums. A commercial auto scorecard might look something like this. That you take the accidents per driver, kind of like I showed you on violations and stuff, and the average driver age, kind of like I showed you, and you rescale all this stuff so that it looks intuitive. So that, in effect, what you've done is rescaled all those indicated relationships in pure premium into something that scales to the number of points that you find intuitively attractive. It's nothing more than an exercise in algebra to rescale all those indicated relativities into some indicated score points. So in this case, you know, getting 75 points for having less than two-tenths of one violation per driver gets you a maximum of 75 points. That's more predictive and more meaningful than the accidents per driver, where the maximum you can get is 40 points. So you can kind of get a feel for which of these factors are more important. In terms of credit score, in this particular example, there's five breaks: acceptable, marginal, no score, superior, and unacceptable. And you can see that it actually has a pretty decent amount of leverage to it, 125 possible points, and so on and so forth. Interesting, the MVR no hits. Typically, if you've got more than 10% of your drivers that are showing up no hits, that ought to raise your eyebrows a little bit. And that's not something that actuaries would typically think about, but the underwriters do. That was something the underwriters taught, at least taught me, that if you're getting a high persistency of no hits on MVRs, there's a reason for that. You should be able to get pretty high hit ratios on MVRs, and if you're getting drivers that are no hitting at a fairly high no hit rate, that's a problem that needs to be contemplated. And it's not a huge thing. I mean, it's worth 35 points, but it does influence pure premiums. And so you add up your points, you multiply by the page number, you go to your table, and you know, if I got 700 points, I get a 40% rating credit. And I can implement that as an underwriting guideline. I can implement that as a tiering guideline if I've got a number of statutory companies I can use. I can implement that as a guideline schedule credit starting point, or any combination of those things. One of the things that we're seeing in the middle markets that's really fascinating is that a number of our alternative markets programs and a number of our insurers that work in that space contract with either internal employees or external vendors to do loss control surveys. And a number of those vendors, GAB, Gallagher, a number of them, produce a score. And we're finding this has some really neat applications in predictive modeling, in the sense that a middle market, you know, a decent-sized commercial auto fleet that scores 79% on their safety, on their screening, on their regulatory compliance, on all these factors shown, is a different risk and has a different pure premium expectation than somebody that scores 92. Even in a kind of large markets or kind of high end of the middle markets program, where you're very self-rated, you know, you're fully self-rating up to, you know, some per occurrence limit maybe, there is still some predictive bias based on this loss prevention score. So if you're used to doing loss picks as part of a captive, the loss pick tends to be biased based on what this loss control survey score is. And it's a fascinating trend in how predictive modeling, I would expect that has something to do with this National Underwriter article on trucking. Okay, I mentioned loss prevention devices, and I just want to kind of bring your attention to maybe one of the best in class ones. And I don't get a commission from them, I'm not advertising. Here's somebody that's really good. DriveCam does this really cool thing where they install cameras on buses, on taxi cabs, on long haul trucks, and keeps a running 20-second video of each of those cameras. And anytime there's an abrupt change in speed, anytime there's an abrupt change of direction, it saves the 10 seconds before the abrupt change and the 10 seconds after, and beams it to some control center and puts the risk manager of that bus company, that taxi cab company, that long-haul trucking firm, or that petroleum hauler, puts them in a chance where they can review that incident. As evidence, if there's a nasty accident, we've had a number of cases where that video evidence got them dismissed from a nasty BI claim, especially when you're dealing with buses, where it allowed them to identify erratic driving by the drivers and train them or get rid of them. So some really neat stuff. And this idea of using the kind of GPS, kind of beamy up Scotty technology also helps you track where the drivers are driving, when they're driving. So there's some neat incentive effects. A number of our self-insureds use this thing, and we've seen actually meaningful results on their indicated pure premiums just by implementing this product. What are the key players doing? I thought it was interesting that the National Underwriter article pointed out, too, that Progressive is enhancing their trucking program, and that Hartford, they interviewed one of the senior management folks from Hartford and asked about what they're doing with their commercial auto program. So let's take a quick look at that. Progressive's program, and I didn't show you a snapshot of the filing because it's big. They look at body type. So not just what the weight of the vehicle is, but what kind of truck is it? Is it a flatbed? Is it a lowboy? Is it a refrigerator box? Does it have a crane on the back? So all sorts of things about, is it a tanker? All sorts of things about the body type of the truck beyond just weight. They look at vehicle use in industry in a much more refined way than most companies do, along with the ICC weight classes and the detailed territories that Progressive's famous for. Interestingly, they have tried to implement personal use surcharges. And it's kind of like Guide One used to do the thing for non-drinkers and non-smokers, and you got into the program if you signed to, I'm a non-drinker and a non-smoker, and it was kind of a trust but verify thing. So as long as you didn't have a DUI, you could stay in Guide One's program. Well, it's kind of that way with Progressive and their personal use. As long as they don't see an accident at 2 in the morning, you can probably still get the personal use, avoid the personal use surcharge. But the minute you have that 2 a.m. Incident, chances are you're going to get stuck with it. They do some really neat things with paid in full discounts as a proxy of credit and their own internal billing information. They take credit and MVR scoring into the schedule rating plan, interestingly, and it's a much more robust, much more tangible schedule rating plan. There's a lot more detail to it. And they also do an independent experience rating plan that's pretty darn cool. Hartford, my favorite. Here's what Hartford does. And we're going to have a little game, so don't read ahead. I hope it's not on the same page as the slides. Don't peek. Let's look at what Hartford's doing. They're going to score the MVRs. They're going to add average driver age, youthful surcharge, and then a bunch of credit factors. So they didn't grab a credit score. Instead, they went and chose a bunch of things that contribute to credit score. They didn't buy the score. They bought the raw data. Years in business, they've rolled into their scorecard. Industry classification, interestingly, they've taken into their scorecard. TTTs to PPT mix contributes to what they're doing. Three-year loss frequency, it's almost kind of a proxy for experience rating. Now, with all that stuff, and I'll admit, it's a fairly comprehensive scorecard. What do you think the leverage is? What do you think the difference between lowest and highest is? Now, see, this guy's back here cheating and looking at the other slide. What do you think the leverage is? Almost 8 times. The highest tier in Progressive scorecard, Progressive, Hartford scorecard, is almost 8 times the lowest tier they can produce based on these factors. I'm really happy they had to file this in a state because it's a really cool program. Okay, for more information, I put a few copies of a monograph I've written recently. This is basically the best review article, so if you just want to wait and read the best review article when you get home, that's great. If you'd rather pull the monograph, I've put this very succinct link. feel free to go check it out on Pinnacle's website. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brett. I'm going to try and turn it over to Brett.
I got it.
Oh, I'll get out of your way.
Okay. Thanks. Is it usually this slow?
Yeah.
Okay.
Reflects the user.
If it would start, I'm going to take a step back and not get into so much detail. Rob did quite a good job on covering a couple of elements to look at for commercial auto. But I'm just going to talk about mainly the opportunities and the pitfalls in thinking about a commercial auto predictive modeling project. And you can generalize it pretty much to any commercial line type of product. So we're going to touch on some opportunities, go through some of the pitfalls, the common pitfalls for commercial lines, and then just briefly touch on price optimization, get you thinking about it. Very basic explanation on what it is and the advantages of it, and then hopefully the sessions later on this afternoon will satisfy your curiosity even more. So to start off, the first opportunity is market segmentation. I mean, that was the basic point behind why you would look at quite a few different rating variables or any type of underwriting criteria to try and differentiate your risk. The better job you do at market segmentation, the more profitable you would be, and that would pretty much be a competitive advantage in the commercial lines marketplace right now. Rob mentioned how the pricing on the commercial lines side isn't very sophisticated, and that's true. A lot of the sophistication there lies in the underwriting. The underwriting, for the most part, isn't very scientific. A lot of it is just subjective judgment of an account or a review of an account. So to go through this example, we're going through two risks. The true cost is about 50 to 100. So double the risk propensity for risk B. Let's just assume there's a constant profit load of $5. Company one decides to average the rates out and rate each risk the same and not differentiate in that new variable that they might not even know about. Company two decides to charge what they believe is the true rate with the $5 profit load. So this should be pretty straightforward with what happens as far as anti-selection. Risks go towards the lowest price, with company two that charges the correct rate end up getting the lower price business, versus company one that has the average rate, they end up getting the higher price business. So basically, I mean, that's the whole deal behind market segmentation, what you're trying to get at. You're just trying to, you know, build in some competitive advantage that none of your competitors reflect, whether it's in the underwriting or any of their rating. And of course, you can't do that with traditional actuarial approaches. In a multivariate framework, I mean, the possibilities are endless. You can test and examine as many predictors as you want from a lot of various data sources, whether it's geographic external data sources, whether it's underwriting information that you've captured and put into a usable data format, to new data sources. Rob mentioned the geo-tracking data source. That's something companies are doing quite a bit of, and they track the incidence of hard braking or quick acceleration and so forth. The second biggest opportunity in predictive modeling on the commercial lines side is just quantifying your underwriting knowledge. I think if you've got two underwriters and one was hired last month versus another one that was with you for about 3 years, and you ask them to underwrite the same risk, chances are they're going to come up with a totally different schedule, credit or debit. Maybe not totally different, but they're definitely not going to be exact. So with commercial auto, I mentioned the simplistic class plan where we get into either type of vehicles, territory. Most of the competitive advantage is on the underwriting side, which is done through schedule rating, and it's all subjective. So in this case, just looking at a schedule rating plan, and overall, your overall credit or debit could have a swing of about 50%, with some of the drivers being prior loss experience, number of drivers on that account or policy that are under 25, some reflection of the management, whether it's how long the management's been in place, or some type of financial score of the whole business and fleet characteristics, what proportion of light trucks to heavy trucks and so forth. And that's all great, and that's all worked pretty well with all these subjective, judgments on what an account should get in, as far as scheduled credits and debits. One thing to keep in mind is, when you go through a really competitive soft market, people lose track of what they're really trying to do. There's no scientific way of focusing your goal on profits or growth when it's just up to people's judgments on what credit or debit an account gets. Okay, so the key thing here where we've seen a lot of lift or a lot of value whenever a new commercial lines type of company starts implementing predictive models is, well, a lot of our competitive advantage is in our underwriting. So which factors can be categorized and which ones can't? To give you some examples, prior loss experience, that's something that can be measured. That's something that can be calculated from your claims data sets. The past experience mod that you're applying to these accounts. How many claims are really large claims? The exposures, the radius of operation, number of vehicles, locations. A lot of this can also be validated using a lot of external data sources. The commercial credit data sources, D&B and Experian. Experian especially, they have a lot of good commercial information that we've used in a lot of projects that we've found to be really valuable. And that leaves you, that'll always leave you with items that are difficult to categorize. There's always going to be something you know about the account as an underwriter that you can't, I mean, it's not collected out there. And it's just based on your judgment, whether you've known this account for a while or, you know, or you can't even measure it. How do you categorize or capture how effective a loss control program is? I'm sure if you get creative enough, you can think of ways to do that. But, you know, the effectiveness of the loss control program and the condition of the vehicles, that's probably not too easy to get in a nice little database format. The third opportunity, which should be pretty straightforward, is you reduce the double counting. You know, once you start looking at underwriting variables or marketing and rating variables all in a multivariate framework, you can scientifically assign the impact of, you know, a rating variable versus an underwriting variable. So stuff like, you know, good loss experience that you might reflect in your rating plan, it doesn't get double hit with the discount, you know, based on an underwriting credit. Renewal policy is the same thing. You know, underwriters thinking of an account that's had good experience and they've been with you for 3 years. So it's just another framework to isolate underwriting and rating. Okay. So this is what, I mean, what most of this seminar talks about is, you know, building risk models, where you get at the frequency and the severity drivers based on all of these rating variables or predictors that you've captured. And what you're trying to get at is the risk model. And that's where all the information lies. How you implement that risk model depends on, well, what are you going to throw into your rating plan? Most companies, when they first get into predictive modeling on the commercial side, don't like making any filings, so they pick up a lot of that lift on the commercial line side. So for the most part, you'll see all of their rating factors being fixed to how it currently is filed, and you know, they'll look at the impact of fixing those factors on the underwriting variables they're collecting, and that'll be their new underwriting scorecard. So Rob had a more detailed scorecard, but you pretty much get the idea where, in this case, we have four different variables that are part of the scorecard. Each of them have a score. Loss control program, claims in the past 3 years, how many years of the company, and their financial credit, their company credit. And all of that kind of translates into a nice, you know, one variable, an overall score with a relativity. And that's the science behind, you know, giving direction to underwriters on what the automated underwriting schedule credit or debit should be. Instead of letting them choose a plus or minus 50%, you can narrow it down to a plus or minus 10% to cover, you know, the elements you couldn't categorize. What's also been done is that score, and this is the same scorecard, you know, gets translated into tiers. The really high score, the accounts that get a really high underwriting score get into a higher rated tier, and vice versa for the really low underwriting score. One big thing you hear about on the commercial line side is how everyone's business is, you know, very different. I mean, we write a lot of different accounts. There's another carrier out there. They do a lot of commercial auto, but you know, the relationships they have and the business they go after is very different. So that's the next big advantage in doing a multivariate or predictive modeling type of analysis. You know, traditionally you haven't reflected all of the uniqueness in your book of business. I mean, when you look at a one-way type of analysis, when you start trying to pick up, you know, your experience, let's say in this example, for zone one and for buses, I mean, you start to break your data set out when you do one-way analysis into a lot of different small pieces. With respect to predictive modeling, what it does is it kind of creates a web on your data set. It uses all the information in zone one to give you information on what the correct price or the correct risk propensity of your zone one should be. And it uses all the information within your buses to get at that same answer, instead of a one-way analysis, which would just use all of your information in that one box, the Y2P. So that's another key advantage that comes out of a multivariate analysis on the commercial line side. The last opportunity I'm going to talk about is territory and why commercial lines carriers haven't really done much with territory. I think the truth of it is it's pretty ugly. I mean, you have zip code or you have a lot of territories that, honestly, no one has enough data to really get something credible out of it. Territory is also related to a lot of the variables you have, especially with external data with respect to geodemographic. I talked about the high correlation with the other rating variables. This is something you couldn't really do in a one-way analysis. When you do map it all out, here's the comparison between a univariate versus a one-way. And what are we looking at? Let's just say, and I really forget what this plot is about, but it's to do with pure premium and the pure premium relativities. When you try to geographically map it on a univariate basis, it really doesn't tell you much. If you can see the mouse, it doesn't really tell you much about what geographic pockets there are, you know, that might be hotspots with respect to having a high relativity or low relativity. When you do adjust that in a multivariate framework, it just becomes more apparent. This might not be the best example, just because, you know, it looks like this might be a city where the territories are more refined. But when you do this, you know, statewide for a certain state, you'll see certain hotspots that, you know, don't get picked up by all the other underwriting and rating variables that you have. And when you spatially plot it into a geographic form, you can see where there are certain things happening on a geographic level. So those are the main five key points to think about when you're thinking about doing a predictive modeling project on the commercial lines. And I think those are the main reasons why you'd want to do them. Segmentation being the highest, and definitely separating your underwriting and rating pretty much next in line. The next couple slides goes through a couple issues you're going to deal with, and they're probably more prevalent for the commercial lines side of things, and definitely the first one being data. I mean, commercial lines data, just because of their lack of sophistication with respect to rating, I use that reasoning, I guess, and there could be a lot of different reasons for it. I've seen it in terrible shape. I mean, companies don't have the level of detail that personal lines carriers have. There are challenges with matching claims to the correct policy records or the correct exposures. So I kind of grouped them into five themes, and I'm going to skim through them: volume, quality, dimensionality, format, and development. So, of course, there's the volume of data, and we kind of touched a bit on that with respect to territories. You know, you're going to have tons of classes or, you know, tons of different zip codes with not enough data. Quality of data. You know, the more and more new tools you get into, the more and more external data sources you rely on, the more and more sources you use to create data into usable format, whether it's underwriting applications that are in a nice little PDF electronic format, and you want to transfer that into the table, I mean, you're going to come up with a lot of issues with respect to quality of data. Null values, you know, what do they mean? Are they valid values? Or, I mean, should they be zeros? Do they represent some bias? Were they not filled out for a certain reason? Linkage between policy and losses, I mentioned before. Too much pre-banding of the data. And this is a common one, for a lot of data systems where there's only a certain amount of space they can fill, whether it's class code or, you know, some other rating variable, they kind of group them together beforehand. I mean, that's something in a multivariate analysis that kind of could hurt you. You know, the more granular you have your data or your predictor set up, the better you are, because you could always group them on the analysis stage. No mapping of old groupings or old classifications or old territories into current definitions. That's that can be a fun challenge. And then inconsistency between variables. You know, there are two different variables that kind of get at the same thing, but, you know, they could have no overlap and they have to be mutually exclusive, but the data doesn't show it that way. And of course, with some commercial lines, you know, when you start getting into the developmental losses and you start taking your predictive modeling one step further and not just using, you know, overall loss development factors to develop your losses and start getting into a predictive model to come up with your loss development, you're going to have more issues there, because now you're getting at, you know, each and every claim transaction level of detail. The next slide goes over dimensionality, format, and development. That's one thing on the commercial line side. As far as claims are concerned, there's tons of claims information. There's more detail than you'd ever want. But as far as the policy side of things, I mean, you've just got the main rating characteristics, which aren't too many, and whatever else they might capture. So a lot of the intelligence or a lot of work has been done on the claim side to have a lot of information. That's not really that useful. I mean, because that doesn't really drive your frequency side of things. Because you need to know, you know, you need to have that information on your exposures that don't even have a claim. Underwriting characteristics that might not even be available. You know, you might on a piece of paper write how many violations a certain account has had or how many drivers under the age 25, but that's something that might not be available in a nice electronic format. I've had a lot of companies go through and hire interns or temps and go through their storage rooms and kind of put all of that data in a nice standard usable format. Claim development I touched on before, where you're using predictive models to kind of get at what your ultimate claims would be that you can use to build your severity. So a couple suggestions on each of these data items. As far as volume is concerned, normally we start off as many years as you can get. Of course, you're going to have consistency issues the further back you go. But for the most part, you know, a lot of the commercial lines projects I've done, I mean, they don't have a lot of exposure in each of the policy years. As far as quality, I mean, that's a fine balance. You can make a whole new project just taking care of assembling your data set for a predictive modeling project. Garbage in, garbage out. You know, the cleaner your data, the more reflective it's going to be, or the more patterns you're going to find and be able to reflect certain, attach certain predictors as loss drivers. Dimensionality. I talked about this before where, you know, adding your underwriting factors to supplement your rating factors, I mean, that's the key here. I mean, without that, you couldn't separate your underwriting and rating effects in a nice systematic way or a scientific way. And a lot of people think of, oh, well, we'll get external data to do that. We use, on our underwriting application, we look at the financial score or how long management has been in place, so let's just go ahead and get external data, and that might be the only option. A lot of times what we've seen is the data from the both of the data sources could be very different, and your internal data probably is better than your external data source. So if it's not too much of an effort, that's something that needs to be thought about. You might want to think of doing it in the short term or just have long-term plans to capture that data electronically. Format. There are a lot of different ways to set up your data set with respect to a BOP type of policy where you have a lot of different coverages set up and it's just represented as one record. So you might want to split that out. With respect to workers' comp, indemnity, and medical. So your coverages, your perils, that's something you want to think about. And then I mentioned the development, building loss development models, using predictive models to get a true estimate of your overall ultimate claims. The two key ones here, and of course buy-in is important with any type of major investment, but the two key ones here on the commercial line side is underwriting and management. So management, to start off, and start off from the bottom. Of course, it's the most important with respect to financial aspect of things and how much a project in terms of resources might take. With respect to the underwriting, there are a lot of underwriters, and if they're not involved from day one, they feel like this predictive modeling is kind of getting at what they're doing with their underwriting. It feels like it's going to take a job away from them. And they've got to be on the same page as to the value that this brings into the overall process. The value being a systemized underwriting scorecard, putting more science to it, and being able to test that in the future once you have collected all of that data. Market perception, I mean, this is somewhat straightforward, but it's basically, you know, the wait and see approach. On the commercial line side, when predictive modeling started probably close to about eight to 10 years ago, you could kind of look at the experience of the companies that got into predictive modeling earlier on and kind of plot their combined ratios and see somewhat of a difference between the late followers. So a lot of people think of, oh, well, you know, we'll just wait and see. And, well, what's happening in the personal line side, well, now it's not even an option whether or not you need to implement a predictive modeling solution for your rates. It's more an issue of anti-selection. If you don't, you're pretty much going to be unprofitable. The other one is how lengthy of a process it could be. The data collection, I've gone through enough projects where I think, you know, the data collection can be about 90% of the project at in the worst case, and it could probably have it be that long. The key thing to realize here is you're never going to get it all right the first time around. There's a lot of lift in an overall, you know, predictive modeling analysis, especially if you've got all the possible predictors you possibly can, that you're not even going to be able to implement or realize right off the bat. It's going to cause a huge disruption in your book. So the key thing here is to focus on and break it down to small pieces. Maybe there are key drivers you want to focus on the first time around. You know, the top five rating variables or underwriting variables that you want to kind of put some science behind. The other part is a lot of carriers thinking other companies aren't using any predictive modeling in the personal lines. Well, as I mentioned, the very first time people started getting into it, the simplest way to implement it is keep your rates filed the same and then pick up a lot of that lift that's not reflected in those factors that you've selected through your underwriting. So there are a lot of companies that are doing that, and that's what makes it really difficult to see, because the underwriting portion, as you all know, is not necessarily filed, and it's not as transparent as the rating. The fourth pitfall that people confuse a lot is predictive modeling versus rate making, and what that is and what that isn't. There are some people that, during the predictive modeling phase and building their models, they start implementing a lot of regulatory constraints and things that they could do and not do in a competitive environment and so forth. What we recommend is keeping those two things separately. Build the best models you possibly can without any constraints. You know, just let your past experience speak and allocate, you know, the correct relativities to the correct drivers, and then you start getting to rate making, which is when you start putting a lot of the business considerations into it. Of course, as I mentioned, you're not going to, you know, want to move from a standard rating plan down to a multivariate solution with 30 new predictors, because, as you can imagine, the swing is going to be quite large. So that's going to go into, you know, what goes into my proposed rate set. Of course, it's not my indicator results, because that's just not something you're going to live with. System constraints, that should be a pretty common one, where there's no way, or for the most part, a lot of carriers, there's no way they can you know, handle 30 new variables as easily, and that's just more for long-term type of planning process. Competitive issues, you may know you're not getting adequate rate for certain risks, but you have enough of a book of business or a proportion of a book of business in there that you're not willing to deal with the rate inadequacy, and you want to keep your rates the same. And then regulatory constraints, what you can and can't do. And none of these are new. None of these are, you know, new issues that are caused by predictive modeling, but they're just business considerations that go into getting at the proposed rates, which should be not thought about when you're trying to get at an indicated risk model. So the four pitfalls I went through are data, and that's always going to be that's always going to be somewhat of a hurdle, especially the first couple times you try and set a data set up. Company buy-in, market perception, you know, what people think other people are really doing out there, and the wait-and-see approach, and then implementation, what indicator rates are versus proposed rates. The next couple slides, I think there are just five slides, and it gets into price optimization and what it is. And I think traditionally when people think about predictive modeling, they're just thinking about risk models, frequency, severity models, or loss ratio models, however they'd like to look at it, but pretty much getting at the true cost of the risk from a pure premium point of view. price optimization starts building a bit more information into the pricing process. So you've got your risk models, you've got your demand models, you've got your corporate strategy, and it kind of takes all of that information together, and comes up with your optimal set of rates. What are the rates I need to charge to get at my goals? Are my corporate goals based on growth or profitability or both? And of course, there's not one clean answer. They're all going to be, the answer is going to be different depending on different segments, different regions, and so forth. So just to start off, what are you doing with predictive modeling? I mean, you're using predictors or variables, underwriting rating, you're using weights, exposures, let's just say in this case, and you're trying to measure something, whether it's frequency, severity, pure premium, whether it's what's the probability of someone converting to you, what's the probability of a book of business staying as you're insured, given the fact that you're in a certain competitive environment and you just hit them with a $200 increase in premium. So people use predictive models to get at conversion and retention models. So it's pretty much the same thing. It is predictive modeling. It's just you're not dealing with the risk cost side of things. So the loss cost modeling that I mentioned, you're looking at frequency, severity, getting at correct rates. It's getting at profitability when you compare those correct rates with what your rate manual is. Conversion and retention, those collectively get referred to as demand models. It gets an idea of what the marketplace out there, what their reaction is to your product. What their reaction is to getting your product or what the reaction is with respect to your product compared to other products out there in different competitive environments under different rate changes. So both of those get kind of grouped together or considered together, and then you start building up what's known as customer value. That can be measured a lot of different ways. So now the problem or the optimization ends up being not what's my most profitable rate, which is what we focused on a lot, but which customers are more valuable. And of course, there are a lot of different ways of looking at that. Are you talking about short-term, long-term, and so forth? So I'm going to go through a really basic example here, and I've got three risks, and they've all got the same flat margin, and you can kind of relate it to the same $5 risk load I had earlier on. And focusing on the left-hand side, for each of these risks, this is my distribution of my book of business. Most of them are C, and I have my smallest exposures, risk A, and so forth. And here's some measure of the total profit. With respect to optimal loads, what it's getting at is using all of that information with respect to demand models and, the reaction of the marketplace to your product and staying with you versus converting and becoming your insured. Converting and becoming an insured. Price optimization gets at adjusting those risk loads so that you maximize some overall corporate goal. And in this really simple example, it is, let's say we want to maximize total profit. Of course, you're not going to change, you're not going to charge everyone, increase the risk load on everyone, and be really profitable because you've got a retention model that, that's going to react. You're going to get people that leave you. You're going to get people that don't convert. Your conversion ratio is going to be really low. So it pretty much optimizes based on the characteristics of each and every risk. It optimizes what the profit load should be to get at your overall corporate goal, in this case being profit. So basically, what is it looking at? It's looking at different drivers and different customer characteristics other than, your overall risk model. It gets into price, consumer price utility, the demand for your product, and how different it is. The KPIs in this case are the key performance indicators. How are you going to evaluate this optimization, or what's going to be your goal? Is it profitability versus growth? And are you thinking short-term, long-term, and what are those different terms? And what are those different market segments that you're going to have these different goals with? And the last slide here gets into, strategy. I mean, the mathematics behind this can be fairly complicated, but there are a couple different ways of attacking it. The first one is, I'm just going to build in my risk loads by capping and flooring premium changes. I know who I want to be more competitive on, and I know who I can be less competitive on. Maybe I'm going to just go about it that way. The second item I had here is your risk, your setting up your risk load. That's a factor of your market rate, so just a margin adjustment. Third one is profit tables. You know, by maybe risk class, you have a certain profit table type of loading. And then the last one being individual customer pricing, where each and every unique risk in your book of business really has a unique risk load. That's the ones that the regulators are going to have a lot of fun with, because it gets away from that rates not being excessive or inadequate and so forth. So a couple things to consider when you're thinking about price optimization, the distribution channel. The way customers see your product is going to be differently, whether they're shopping on the internet and they have access to a lot of different rates, or even if they're going through an independent agent. There's some agents that might just have, you know, might just look at three different companies versus another one that might look at 25. The available technical analysis, you know, how technical do you want to get to kind of answer this whole, optimization problem? And then lastly, is your rating engine capabilities. Can your rating engine support something that sophisticated or that complex? So that should give you something to think about with respect to, you know, moving the next step after the normal standard risk models that we mostly talk about. That was pretty much what I intended to cover. I think we have we have 20 minutes, so.
Yeah, we have plenty of time for questions. So anybody in the audience?